The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Florence Nash from Triangle Radio Reading Service, and for the next half hour, I'm going to be reading to you some more from the October-November issue of AARP Magazine, and then, time allowing, we'll probably switch over to the AARP Bulletin for November. And our programming today is generously underwritten by Salibi Chiropractic. Salibi Chiropractic welcomes the geriatric community with any neck, back, or hip issues. You can call them at 919-782-4733. Again, that's 919-782-4733. Now, from AARP, we, in the personal best section, they have several short profiles of people who are doing interesting things. I think we did one last week. Here's another one. This is Personal Best, My Campaign, Absolute Beginner, a political novice, nonagenarian, Vito Perillo ran for mayor and won. Retired electrical engineer Vito Perillo, 94, is the mayor of Tinton Falls, New Jersey. And he writes, 4 months before my town's mayoral election last November, I decided to run. I was disgusted with the tax increases in our town, and the incumbent mayor had run unopposed in the previous election. I had never held office, but I thought I could win. I was an engineer for the Department of Defense for almost 40 years. After I retired, I worked for a CPA firm for 10 years on budgets and audits for municipalities. That gave me a lot of useful knowledge. When I told my family that I was going to run, they asked me to reconsider, but when they saw I was serious, they backed me 100%. On election night, we gathered in a restaurant to hear the results, and when we heard I was winning, they couldn't believe it. The final results were announced around 10 p.m. The TV station started calling, and I lined up interviews for the next day. I turned down a couple of stations, and they came anyway. It was bedlam, but at the same time, it was nice. There were 2 months between my election and my swearing in, but I didn't wait to start work. Shortly after winning, I met with some of the council members and attended a couple of budget meetings. If you want to make people's lives better and your neighbors give you the honor of letting you try, you have to be ready to dig right in. And that is as told to Pat Olson. And next, under the personal best, we've got My Cause, Holding Up the Sky. Academy Award winner F. Murray Abraham helps war victims in his father's homeland. My father's parents came to America in the 1920s because there was a famine in Syria. America saved their lives. It's as simple as that. They never forgot that. And my father taught us to be super patriots. My two brothers are buried in a military cemetery in Texas. I love my work. It's the source of my energy. I'm looking at 80, but feel like I'm 40. But I'm constantly balancing my good fortune against the darkness I see in my grandparents' war-torn homeland. I have relatives there who have lost their homes and are scattered. Some have been fortunate enough to make it out of Syria. We'd like to bring them to America because we have places with family where they can stay. But that's so difficult that we're focusing on helping them reach some other safe haven instead. And they are the lucky ones. Millions can't get out. So when the opportunity arose to bring attention and aid to this tragedy, I leaped at it. I became a spokesperson for the Multifaith Alliance for Syrian Refugees, a network of more than 90 organizations coordinating aid for people within Syria who have been displaced. The Alliance has helped deliver over $114 million in food, clothing, and medical relief by working through many religious groups. Georgette Bennett, who dreamed up the Alliance, is the child of Holocaust survivors. I'm Syrian Christian. Buddhist, Hindu, Muslim, and Sikh organizations are also involved. My grandfather, Murai, had a favorite parable. A sparrow heard that the sky was falling and lay down on his back. Along came one of the king's horsemen. He said, "What are you doing?" The sparrow said, "I heard the sky's falling, and I'm holding it up." The horseman was amused. "Do you really think you can hold up the sky with those little legs?" And the sparrow said, "We do what we can." When people volunteer to help, it means so much. It's a way of saying you're not helpless. You can change the world for the better. There is meaning in even the smallest action. This was told to Jean Santoro. And F. Murray Abraham, age 79, is featured in the upcoming film How to Train Your Dragon, The Hidden World. Now, the next personal best is travel tips. Sisterhood adventures. Women seek like-minded travel companions. The number of women wanting female-only trips has skyrocketed in recent years, with companies like Damesley, Woe Travel, and Living Big Travel devoted entirely to such excursions. Other long-standing tour operators, including Intrepid Travel and Road Scholar, now provide these kinds of trips in addition to their other ones. Some women say they'd feel like a fifth wheel being single among a bunch of couples, and that a wonderful camaraderie develops when guys aren't around. Living Big founder Mary Caccini says most women who take the company's small group trips don't know their fellow travelers, but by maybe the second dinner, it really does feel like a group of girlfriends. Road Scholar, which runs educational trips for people 50 and older, offered 41 women-only adventures this year, up from 14 in 2011. Joanne Bell, Road Scholar's senior vice president for programs, says active outdoor trips are among the most popular because some women feel like if there were men, there'd be more pressure to pick up the pace. Jane Detloff, 76, a retired teacher in Minneapolis, has participated in 14 women-only bike trips across the globe through VBT. "It's non-competitive," she notes. "We encourage and help one another, and I think that really appeals to women." This is by Christina Yanzito. Now, here's some tips on a few popular women-only getaways. Living Big Travel: 9 days exploring the history and culture of Vietnam. That's $3,500. Road Scholar: 6-day spirituality and wellness retreat in Sedona, Arizona. That's $1,200. And REI Women's Adventures: 4 days backpacking in the Great Smoky Mountains is $850. Day away time. Staying at a no-frills hotel? No worries. You can buy a day pass to enjoy swank amenities at a fancy hotel or resort, often for just $25 or $30. A few sites where you can find and book day passes online. Resort Pass, which is resortpass.com, has a selection of about 70 properties in 25 cities. Example, the Hyatt Regency Grand Cypress in Orlando. You can spend a day lounging at its half-acre pool with waterfalls for $30. Or Resort for a Day, which is resortforaday.com, offers all-inclusive resort passes with a focus on cruise passengers, mostly in the Caribbean and Mexico. A $90 day pass to Jewel Dunn's River Beach Resort and Spa in Jamaica gets you frozen pina coladas, a jerk chicken lunch, chilled face towels, and more. And for a nostalgia trip, TWA Hotel readies for takeoff. Passengers will be able to relive the golden age of air travel this spring when the retro-chic TWA Hotel opens at Kennedy Airport. It'll be housed in the former TWA Flight Center, built in the early 60s and shuttered since the iconic airline folded in 2001. The old terminal will become the hotel's 200,000 square foot lobby, its sunken lounges carpeted in chili pepper red. The 512 guest rooms will be Mad Men style, with vintage rotary phones and mod furniture. Next, under personal best, we have My Sunday Stroll, Exploring Harlem. The historic Manhattan neighborhood is worth a subway ride uptown. This is written by Nori Quintos. I'm not much of a clapper, swayer, or amener, but At Harlem's Abyssinian Baptist Church, the Spirit moves me. My old college classmate Robert, a New York transplant from the South who attends this historic black church, has invited me to the 9 a.m. worship service for regulars. Tourists should attend at 11:30 a.m. The sermon is stirring. Music from gospel to jazz to Afrobeat to salsa is the soundtrack of this large swath of Upper Manhattan, which ranges north of Central Park to 155th Street. It's a straight shot on the subway, about 30 minutes from Midtown, to this neighborhood, which has its own rhythm, particularly on a Sunday, when songs of praise emanate from many of the 400-some houses of worship. What started out as a Dutch village in the 17th century became the undisputed center of black culture in the 1920s and 30s, with a flourishing of music, art, literature, and activism that became known as the Harlem Renaissance. Josephine Baker, Duke Ellington, W.E.B. Du Bois, and Jacob Lawrence all lived or passed through here. A stroll in central Harlem is like walking through a history book with the sights of momentous events and larger-than-life characters on every corner. From the Abyssinian, it's only a block to Stryver's Row, an aristocratic set of 19th-century townhouses that were reluctantly made available to upwardly mobile African Americans, or Stryvers, including Scott Joplin, U.B. Blake, and W.C. Handy, after whites had abandoned the area. Today, it's protected, part of the St. Nicholas Historic District. Back on Lenox Avenue, we turn south. A few churches look like the Abyssinian, with neo-Gothic edifices and stained glass windows, but most are storefronts wedged in among Harlem's bodegas, pop-up world music, CD kiosks, and West African textile marts. We grab two seats at the counter at Sylvia's, which has dished out Southern eats since the 60s. Robert has smothered chickens and waffles. I indulge in cornmeal-crusted catfish and fried eggs. Had we decided to go cool rather than classic, we might have walked another block to celebrity chef Marcus Samuelson's Red Rooster. Our stroll ends at a statue of the legendary Duke Ellington and his grand piano. We're heading downtown, but I feel like I've only skimmed the surface of this culturally rich neighborhood. Not to worry, Robert reminds me. You can always take the A train back up. Now, some of the Harlem highlights where famous names lived and played. Hamilton Grange. Founding father Alexander Hamilton, of current musical fame, lived in this early federal-style home back when Harlem was a rural retreat. The house is now a National Park Service site you can tour for free, open Wednesday through Sunday. Minton's Playhouse. Established in 1938, by saxophonist Henry Minton, this nightclub builds itself as the birthplace of modern jazz, or bebop. Stars such as Thelonious Monk, Charlie Parker, and Billie Holiday once performed there. Reserve a table to see jazz legends and up-and-comers. And then Langston Hughes House. The poet lived in this row house at 20 East 127th Street for the last 20 years of his life. You can see his typewriter and piano in the parlor. Free, though a $5 donation is suggested. Open Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday. Now the last of our personal best pieces is My New Career. And this is by Martha Hall Kelly, 61, who is the author of the best-selling 2016 novel Lilac Girls. The prequel to it, Lost Roses, will be published next spring. For author Martha Hall Kelly, one afternoon's idle curiosity became a years-long obsession. She writes, "I was never that interested in history. A child of the 60s, I always thought of myself as a feminist, but I happily deferred to my husband, a poli-sci major, when it came to guessing Jeopardy questions or helping our three children with their social studies homework. All those treaties and battle dates just didn't move me. So in the spring of 2000, when I drove a couple of hours north of my home to tour the historic Bellamy Faraday House and Garden in Bethlehem, Connecticut, it was mainly to see the property's famous lilac gardens. My mom had recently died, and I had a sense that the estate, once the country home of philanthropist and Broadway actress Caroline Faraday, would take me out of myself and my sorrow for an afternoon. I lingered among the sweet-scented lilacs, and then, on a whim, decided to tour the interior. Walking through the rambling 18th-century house, I came to Faraday's study, which remains just as she left it when she died in 1990. On her desk stood a black-and-white photo of a group of smiling women. "Those are the Rabbits," the guide told me, "prisoners at Ravensbrück, the largest all-female concentration camp in Hitler's Third Reich." These Catholic women had been arrested during World War II for their involvement in the Polish resistance. They were called rabbits because Nazi doctors turned them into laboratory animals, operating on their legs to insert glass, dirt, and tetanus bacteria, or to remove bone or muscle tissue. Some of the 74 young Polish women subjected to these experiments died of infection or disease. Others were executed when their usefulness ended. But 63 survived the war, and of these, Faraday brought 35 to the United States for rehabilitation. After hearing their story, I was unable to get these brave women out of my head. Recently retired from my job as an advertising copywriter, I had been planning to relax. Instead, day after day, I immersed myself in World War II history. I stayed up late, listening to books on tape about sea battles and the Luftwaffe as my husband slept beside me. Before long, I, a person who had never written anything much longer than a TV commercial, was traveling to Europe for research and working 12-hour days to outline a novel based on the rabbit's story. Funny how curiosity can make a person work harder than any 9-to-5 job ever could. In Poland, I walked the cobblestone streets where the rabbits had acted as couriers for the resistance. And in Germany, I took the same train route that the arrested rabbits were forced to take up to the little town of Fürstenberg, where Ravensbrück concentration camp still stands as a memorial. The camp's barracks are gone now, having left the vast gravel parade grounds where inmates once stood for hours-long roll calls. How strange it was to stand on the site of the demolished camp infirmary, the place where the Nazi doctors had performed their experiments. For me, understanding the rabbit's story meant understanding the whole story, including the most perplexing part. How could doctors, trained healers, participate in this ghastly work? I'd grown up watching the Nazis of Hogan's Heroes and Raiders of the Lost Ark, either bumbling bureaucrats or sociopathic stormtroopers. But the people who ran this camp were not caricatures. They were human beings, although they horribly violated the humanity of others. In Faraday's files, I had found information about the camp's one female doctor, Hertha Oberhäuser, who had helped perform many of the experiments and administered lethal injections. I needed to understand how she was able to do what she'd done. Through research, I discovered that Hertha, an obedient student in Dusseldorf, had grown up in a culture suffused with anti-Semitism. Newspapers operated under directives issued by the propaganda ministry, and the radio waves were firmly controlled by the Reich. I came away seeing Hertha as an accomplished but impoverished young doctor inculcated by a culture of one-sided, hate-filled rhetoric, so loyal that she didn't think to question what she was told. When I returned to Ravensbrück in 2015 for the 70th anniversary of the liberation of the camp, I met two of the rabbits, Stanislava, Stasha, Sledzhikovska, Ozishko, that's a very approximate pronunciation, who passed away last year at age 92, and Wanda Rozovich, now 96, as well as many other former prisoners. Stasha sat in her wheelchair at the edge of the vast Platz. Though she wore thick stockings, it was hard not to notice her legs, shrunken and missing whole muscles and bones. I asked her about Hertha. Stasha shook her head. A monster. We were just girls, but you have to forgive. Forgive? After they tortured and disfigured her and murdered her friends, how could she manage that? For me, it remains a mystery of grace. But it's not for me to forgive Herta, and I don't know if I even should. What I can do is tell her story and show what philosopher Hannah Arendt called the banality of evil, the chilling ease with which seemingly normal people do atrocious things. After so much study of how the Nazis built up their toxic evil world, it's clear to me how vulnerable we all are to this kind of propaganda. I've become infinitely more sensitive to the threat of the resurgence of Nazism and white nationalism and committed to making sure we remember and learn from humanity's mistakes. Stumbling on this story has been a gift. I have a newfound respect for the march of events behind all those names and dates I was so reluctant to memorize. And I'm grateful I can do a small part to help a new generation understand the lessons of the past. This story has given me a deep admiration for the ordinary people caught up in the historical tides, as we all are, if only we could see it. And now, still in AARP magazine, in their upfront column, which is subtitled, What I Know Now, they have had an interview with Roger Daltrey, who is the front man for The Who. And he talks about being caned, keeping his voice, and never getting old. Roger Daltrey, who is now 74, published his autobiography, Thanks a Lot, Mr. Kibblewhite, this fall. And here's what he has to say. Under Meet Mr. Kibblewhite, the title of my book is based on receiving 6 strokes from a cane on my bare ass from that headmaster. As he expelled me, he said, "You'll never make anything of your life, Daltrey. If it's fight or flight, I'll fight. I'll show you." Now, in the fullness of time, I thank him for what he did. The kid was all right. Writing the book, I learned how driven I was. There was something inside me that had to come out. I remember that first time on stage. I was just pretending to be Elvis, as you do when you're 12 years old. It was probably a pretty terrible performance, but in my head, I was Elvis. Maximum R&B. The attitude of The Who was to drive our music through the audience. We didn't want to be a rock and roll band like the Stones or the Beatles. We had my generation, which was aggressive, much more pointed and sharper edged. This was rock music. In tune with Peter Townsend. The balance works. He's earth, I'm water. Between the two of us, we make things grow. Microphone twirls and misses. We work with different lighting people every night. My eyesight isn't quite what it was, and I lose sight of the mic. The good thing is, I've still never hit anyone with it, or not deliberately. I hope I die before I get old. It wasn't about age and years, but age of the brain, age of your attitude. I have met many people over 90 years old, and they've had young, bright attitudes about life, and their brains are incredible. But I've also met 25 and 30-year-olds who are old, really old. Long live rock? I work all the time. Singers have to sing, especially at this age. If I stopped singing for any length of time now, my voice would be gone in within a year. The biggest problem I'm finding is my hearing is going. That's the manifestation of being part of the loudest rock band in the world. When the song is over. I've suddenly come to the conclusion that it's so simple. You don't retire from this business. This business retires from you. It gets to a point where you just won't be able to do it, and that's it. One day it will. Smash the phones. People who film shows on their phones don't actually experience the show. Can't you keep it in your head? Can't it be important, more important in your head than it is on that bloody thing? It doesn't compute with the way that I feel we should be as a species. And these remarks were as told to Jim Lenehan. Now, here's a little piece on money advice called Money and Margaritas. To build women's confidence, Jean Chatsky taps into the power of talking and laughing. A dozen women, most of us strangers to one another, sat in a bar in Nashville, Tennessee. The women had responded to a shout out on my Her Money podcast. Let's get candid and talk about money. I'll buy the first round. It was a varied bunch, married and divorced, gay and straight, early 30s to 60 plus. They included a lawyer, some corporate types, and a tattoo artist. Here's how this goes, I said, passing around a bag filled with strips of paper. Everyone pulls a question, and then we just start talking. A wave of nervous laughter went around the room. It always does, as I've learned from hosting these gatherings. I call them Her Money Happy Hours. We hate talking about our finances, but I've also learned that these conversations make women feel more powerful and less alone. My biggest financial fear is, read Jeannie Briggs, 49, a PepsiCo sales director. She took a deep breath. It's the fear of running out of money in retirement. Other women reveal their own fears. One had married a man who was deeply in debt. Angela Prestel, 54, an executive at the Credit Union National Association, was concerned that her wife wouldn't engage with their money. If something happened to me, she wouldn't know what to do. Then Prestel read the question she'd drawn. What do you want to do with your money that you feel like you can't? Travel, she said wistfully. She'd become a heavy-duty saver, she explained. Maybe too heavy-duty. The table erupted with suggestions. See a planner. Use a retirement calculator. Open a separate travel fund. The conversation flowed freely as we moved on to topics such as how much money makes us feel, how money makes us feel, and whether we are too risk-averse. As we finished, the women were making plans to meet up without me. That wasn't unusual. Participants tell me they rarely talk about money in their day-to-day lives. But once you open the tap on any forbidden topic, you're thirsty for more. And importantly, these gatherings seem to provide validation that we're not alone, that we're not doing it all wrong, that we'll be okay. We all wanted that affirmation, said Ricky Hall, 62, chief information officer of Nashville-based SMS Holdings. Did you get it? I asked her. Absolutely, she replied. So if you want some more advice, you can read previous columns at aarp.org/JEANCHATZKY. That's aarp.org/Jean Chatsky. So I think we are coming pretty much to the close of our session today. Today's episode of Modern Maturity. But I hope that you'll come back and join me next week and that you've enjoyed today. I'm Florence Nash, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service, and our programming today has been generously underwritten by Salibi Chiropractic. Salibi Chiropractic welcomes the geriatric community with any neck, back, or hip issues. You can call them at 919-782-4733. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired, and this broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast on our website, TriangleReadingService.org. So long till next time. If you have any comments or questions, do give us a call at 919-832-5138. Hope to be with you next week.